Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 14th, 2026. We have a quorum, and I need a motion, Vice Chair Davis, to approve the minutes from the previous meeting, April 9th.
I move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davis has moved the minutes. Any comments? Spelling errors? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes carry. Before we move to our first agenda item, I'd like to take a moment as on my last gavel day, unless, of course, we come back for something strange, and thank our staff. I want to thank our pages, Lydia and Amber, if you would. Stand up. You're here somewhere. There we are. Thank you so much. You both are always here before I am, and you make everything run very smoothly. Also wanted to thank nonpartisan staff, Colby, Helen, thank you so much for being here all the time, adding your voices of wisdom and reason. Thank our partisan staff as well, my CA, Jacob Grunhauser, my CLA, Allison Winter, and our research, Justin Brill, and I'm sure that Chair Cleavorn will be doing something similar to this on Thursday, now that we're surprised, having another meeting. But just wanted to say thank you for everybody who helps make this committee run so well. So on to our first agenda item. Today we have U.S. Bank Stadium and Downtown East Development Economic Impact Study. We've got several folks here, if you'd like to make your way to the testifier table. We've got Mike Vekich. He's the chair of MSFA. And online, we've got Robin Hunden, President CEO, Hunden Partners. Mr. Vekich, thank you for making the trip here this morning, bright and early. Appreciate your time very much. If you would, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael Vekich, and I chair the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority. And I have a couple of short remarks, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Hunden. We are quickly approaching the 10th anniversary of the opening of U.S. Bank Stadium. Even after a decade of operation, this stadium continues to be viewed as one of the best facilities in the country, hosting Vikings football, collegiate and high school athletics, concerts featuring national and international stars, and important community events. There's no question in my mind that we have delivered. Minneapolis hosts a world-class facility for users and visitors. The stadium was built thanks to the financial commitments of the Minnesota Vikings, the state of Minnesota, the city of Minneapolis, and the taxpayers throughout the state. The public dollars have funded the construction operations of the stadium and have been an investment into the quality of life for Minnesota beyond the events that receive most attention here. The authority takes its responsibility very seriously. One way that we can demonstrate the success of U.S. Bank Stadium is to show the community and economic benefits that have been derived from the stadium since it opened. This morning you will hear from Hunden Partners, who have completed an extensive economic analysis of the benefits of U.S. Bank Stadium. Their focus has been on the net new benefits from the stadium. In other words, how can we define the impact of the stadium has had that would not have occurred if the U.S. Bank Stadium had never been constructed? The report breaks down the economic impact in several ways: the impact during construction, the first 9 years of operation, the new development in the Downtown East neighborhood, and projections over the next 20 years. The economic impact from each of these areas is unique, and the total impact is measured in tens of billions of dollars. But I would caution everybody to listen carefully to the presentation to understand the precise economic impact of the stadium for the city and for the state. Hunden will describe the benefits of both the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis. Those are two different ways of understanding the economic impact from the taxpayers' investment, but they are not independent of each other and should not be viewed as two parts of a bigger whole. For example, when a family travels from Chicago for a concert, That can be defined as a net new benefit for both the state and the city. But if they travel from Fergus Falls, that is unlikely to result in a net new benefit for the state, but it certainly qualifies for Minneapolis. Hundon applies the economic benefits appropriately so that both the state and city leaders can better understand the success of the stadium. I will leave it to Hundon to explain the remainder of the methodology of his research. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Mr. Rob Hundon, who is the founder and chair.
Before we do so, Mr. Vekic, if you would, just because I know some people watching online and maybe some people even in the committee are not necessarily 100% sure of what MSFA is versus the Minnesota Vikings, which is your principal tenant. So if you could just very quickly at a high level go through what that is and what that relationship looks like.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, the MSFA is a political subdivision created as a part of the legislation that the MSFA owns and operates the stadium on behalf of the taxpayers. The Minnesota Vikings are the lead tenant in the building. They pay an annual rent and additional dollars to operate the stadium. So the relationships between the two is we hold the operators accountable. We make sure the building stays in a world-class condition, and the Minnesota Vikings play there at least 10 games a year. So that would really be the difference, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Vekic. And I'll just compliment you on the excellent way in which you run it. I had the unfortunate experience of dealing with things before your tenure, and I would like to compliment you on just how well you do on that. So with that, I'll allow you to introduce Mr. Hundon, if you would.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Mr. Rob Hundon, who is the founder and CEO of Hundon Partners, and he will go through the study that we've just completed.
Very good. Mr. Hundon, welcome virtually. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Robin Hundon, as stated, founder and CEO of Hundon Partners. We're based here in Chicago, as you can see in the virtual background behind me, and we've got a team of about 30 folks here. We've been in business for 20 years as of March, and have been in the business of transformational real estate and economic development advisory, consulting, and related practices for about 32 years. And I started off on the public sector side at the City of Indianapolis Bond Bank and mayor's office there. So most of the work that we do is in the public-private sphere. And with that, I will take you through it. We've given ourselves, I think, about 15 minutes to take you through about a 30-slide deck. So we'll move quickly through what is a lot of work that's occurred over about 13 months. And as has been laid out, the whole purpose of this was really to let the MSFA understand since the legislation in 2012 was developed in order to fund the stadium, what has been the impact and what will likely be the ongoing impact during the tenure of the act and the financing. There was state financing that was designed to be over a longer period of time, and then also city financing, very separate ideas. And we're looking at both of those here today. And so this page here gives a high-level summary of the 2012 Stadium Act for construction, and then, of course, the stadium opened in July of 2016. And so what we have done here is really looked at those first nine-ish years of activity, including COVID, which I'll talk about, and then made projections based on sort of a stabilized expectation going forward in a first-class condition as a facility for the remainder of the term. And so we not only look at the stadium, but we also look at what the impact has been in the neighborhood around it. And what we did here, though, was, and you'll see this, we really separated those two things. So there's impact that occurs from people who are coming from outside of the state of Minnesota to events in the stadium. Also those who are coming from outside the city of Minneapolis to events in the stadium. And what does that spending look like inside and outside the stadium? Separate from that, but very related, are the very impactful results that have occurred in the neighborhood directly adjacent and surrounding the stadium. And so that has been looked at as well, and we'll report on that. So just to give you the headlines, and again, this is all about return on investment. The state and the city separately both invested significant dollars into this huge event venue that is top class in the country, and expected a return on that, and expected to do a lot of things. And so the whole purpose of this study is to really assess whether or not that was achieved. And so here we have the headlines on the spending that has occurred net new, again, to the state and to the city. And when we talk about net new, we're only talking about spending that has occurred and or will occur from those coming from outside the jurisdiction. So those coming from outside the state of Minnesota, because one can assume that there's a substitution or a cannibalization effect with entertainment dollars, so that if, say, a stadium wasn't there and you didn't have a Taylor Swift concert or Vikings games or any of the other things going on there, people might likely spend their entertainment dollars elsewhere in the state. So what we do to be very conservative is just really assess those coming from outside the state and or outside the city, depending on which jurisdiction we're looking at doing the ROI analysis on. We also looked at this through two different lenses. One was a nominal lens over the 30-year projection period, and one was what we would call sort of a present value. So you're bringing everything to, in this case, 2025 dollars, so that we can sort of mitigate the effects of past and likely future inflation. So what we have here in terms of headlines are that the total spending, including construction and operations, $14.2 billion in nominal dollars, which results in about $4.3 billion in earnings, which supports about 2,600 jobs and has a tax impact of $1.63 billion. And then if we do that in 2025 dollars, the numbers are a little bit lower, $12.6 billion, and similar resulting ratios in earnings, employment, and taxes. For the city of Minneapolis, again, here we have the smaller the jurisdiction, typically the greater the impact from outside, because you have a higher percentage of people coming from outside the jurisdiction. And I'll get into that a little bit later, but we have all the stats for that we'll share. So $19.3 billion in total output in terms of construction and 30 years of operations. Again, close to $4 billion in earnings, supporting about 3,000 jobs and a tax impact for the city. Again, each has their own types of taxes that they that are impacted by the spending, and so it's different. And here it's nearly $500 million in nominal and about $366 million in 2025 dollars. So when we look at, there's a lot of words here, but what everybody really cares about is, what do we put in, what do we get out, and what's that difference, and did we see a return? And it's interesting because the public sector often gets involved in projects that are a public good, and they don't necessarily expect a return that's easily measurable. However, in the case of this, and this does participate in the market economy, unlike maybe a road or a bridge or something like that, we're able to make measurements of those things. And so on the plus side for the state of Minnesota, $1.63 billion in nominal tax revenue, and then, of course, the $1.22 in 2025 dollars, netting out the initial investment. And then you have the tax revenue in excess of that investment was $1.1 billion in nominal and $525 million in present value dollars. And so from a nominal perspective, comparing the 1.63 to the 518, that's more than a 3-to-1 return, essentially, or 2-to-1 return. And then on the present value perspective, it's almost a 2-to-1 return. And so it's pretty significant and something that we don't see that often. Now, again, this supposes that you keep the facility in top class condition for the next 20 years so that it can continue to achieve the results that it's had. For the city of Minneapolis, different numbers, similar positive returns, $2.5 billion in nominal tax revenue over an investment of $627 million. So again, about a 3-to-1 return there, and then on the constant dollars is closer to a 2.5 to 1 return. And then the neighborhood around it, downtown East, what's been so fascinating to watch is this was really a quite undeveloped and underdeveloped area of town. You had the U.S. Bank Stadium be developed over a period of about 3.5 years, the commons developed around it, and then the stadium ramp that was part of the development as well. Since that time, we've seen nearly 2,000 multifamily units built there, over 500 hotel rooms, 1.7 million square feet of office, and about 200,000 square feet of retail, restaurant, and specialty space. And a lot of these were, we call these newly activated buildings, the 22 buildings that were activated, because some were just sitting there underdeveloped or unused. And just so these were not all new construction. So you had new construction and redeveloped buildings. And so it's a total of 4.6 million square feet and $1.2 billion in direct construction spending. And again, these numbers and the spending associated with that, these are not mixed in with the numbers that I provided you previously. And so, again, that is icing on the cake that if we did measure that and we have measured it separately, it's a huge set of numbers and something I think to be very proud of. The other thing that's really great about this, and if we have time, we can show you how this really helped integrate this part of town into the neighborhoods and knitted that urban fabric and made it a walkable, enjoyable environment where before it was, it wasn't as much in, part of the urban fabric, and there was just a lot of surface parking lots around, which makes people not always feel as safe and comfy in an urban environment when you have lots of vast surface parking. So now it's more dense and walkable and a lot of activation throughout the year. So when we look at, when we break this down, we look at this in really three acts, and I'm going to sort of talk about that throughout this. The first act is construction, and then we have the second act, which is what happened in the first 10 years or 9 years of operations, and then we have the third act, which is projections into the future. So here we have all the documentation, which the sources are many from around the state to get to 8,000 construction workers, 3.5 million hours worked, peak hours on workers on site, 1,500 at its peak, and 300 Minnesota businesses involved that really represented a diverse workforce from across the state, as you can see there on the bottom left. And so the total output was over $2.3 billion, total earnings of about a third of that, 12,000 plus job years. And when we talk about construction at Hunt & Partners, we talk about it in job years because these aren't permanent jobs, these are construction jobs. So over that 3 or so year period, you can understand how 12,000 job years could occur with all of that. And about $50 million in state tax revenue just from construction. So looking back, so past is prologue in many ways, and I'm going to take you through the past of the stadium's event history. And again, the past 9 years really can be divided into three acts as well. You had this sort of the first several years, about 3 years or so, where you had sort of that novelty effect. You had the bloom of the rose, and everybody's excited to have their event there and go on tours and do all those kinds of things. And so in the first 2 years especially, you have significant numbers of events. You know, the number of Vikings games were consistent, of course, but all the other things, other events, tours, special fundraisers, parties, charity events, that kinds of thing. There are many, many of those. And those taper off after the first 3 years. Then we have our COVID years, as you can see there. And despite that, there were still events that occurred there, baseball and others. And of course, you had marquee events that occurred there. You had the Final Four, which has the big Saturday and the big Monday, and then you had the Super Bowl. And so those are counted as marquee events. And again, keeping the facility in top-class condition, you may be in line to get future Final Fours and Super Bowls and other events like that you can bid on. So we had the 3 years of COVID, essentially, that were really impacted by COVID. And then we've had the last 3 years, FY23, 24, 25, where we really start to look at sort of a consistency. And so we took the averages and looked to the future and made a projection that you can see in the far right column for about 156 annual events. And again, those marquee events, we're saying about every other year you'd have something pretty large nature and scale. But of course, continue to host the Vikings and concerts. Your concert business has actually picked up very nicely post-COVID. And so those are all great things. So you can see there in the chart what's really driving the events. Now, we took out the other events from this chart down here because the other events are so massive in number that they would have made all of these colors look really squished. So we took the others, and most of those, by the way, are very small events, whereas these here are large format events. So we took those out of the chart. Then attendance. So same thing happened with attendance. You had super robust attendance going along with all those events in the first 3 years. Then the COVID years, of course, the FY21 was almost nothing. And then the last 3 years, we've really averaged of close, you know, over 1.2, just shy of 1.3. And the average over all years was 1.4 million in attendance, so that's pretty robust. And then we've made a projection of about 1.25, 1.26 million per year going forward. In terms of impact analysis, I know that you all have heard and seen other impact analyses before, so I won't spend a lot of time going through the basics of economic and fiscal impact analysis. But I'll give you super high level. So the way we look at it is events occurring in the facility generate people who are come or induce people to come and spend time and money at those events in the venue and outside the venue. And to the extent that that spending is considered new to the community that we're measuring it for, which is the visitor origin, then we will count their spending inside and outside the venue. We also count spending that the venue makes that the venue spends in order to host these events. And so that all leads to the direct spend, and then we have the multiplier effects, which we'll talk about as well. So here again, total direct spending, we remove the substitution spending from locals who might have spent that same money elsewhere in the state and or the city, depending on what we're measuring, to net out the new spending. And just to give you a sense of it, which we'll get into more detail here in a minute, 26%, depending on the event type, of all visitors that have come to events at U.S. Bank Stadium have been from outside of the state of Minnesota. It may be a surprisingly high number to many people. It was pretty impressive to us. And then net new to the city of Minneapolis, 81%. So four out of five folks who are coming to events at the stadium do not live in the city of Minneapolis. And so that's a huge economic benefit to the city of Minneapolis. In terms of direct, indirect, and induced spending, we have the direct spending, which is what you spend right on site, or I heard the commentary about breakfast burritos. If you went to get a breakfast burrito at the gas station beforehand or after, then that would count as direct spending if it was associated with an event that was occurring on site. And then the indirect spending and induced spending are those next waves of spending that occur in the marketplace. And so indirect is more the supply chain effects. We have to buy food for the concession stands and supplies for the hotels and all those things in order to support the visitors coming to spend. And then the induced is new money in people's pockets who are benefited, like Uber drivers and people who work in hotels and the like. I think that's also a good time to mention that the industries and the kinds of people, the kinds of jobs that are benefited most by activities at the venue are hospitality-related jobs for the most part. And those are jobs that really many people are starting at the bottom of the economic ladder and moving their way up through training and experience. And so these are middle-class jobs and wages and things that are really part of the fabric of the economy. And so I think it's always important as we work in a lot of these venue types that are in the hospitality-related world, these are really important jobs for people to have at the beginning of their career, and for some people it is their career for the long haul, and it's great to be able to support those kinds of jobs. So how do we break down a new to state visitors? You'll find the table at the upper right very fascinating, I think, because we understand the percentage of people who are coming from outside the state of Minnesota to Vikings games and other pro sports events, which was 32% from outside the state, 68% inside the state. For major events, it's the opposite. 34% were Minnesota residents, whereas, so for example, like the Final Four and the Super Bowl, most of those folks were coming from outside the state of Minnesota. Concerts, about three quarters were in-state, one quarter out-of-state. And then for other smaller events, most of those are local, 90% within the state, 10% outside of the state. And so we made, we have the history, and then we made the projections there to shoot that forward over the next 20 years. And then from that, we derive the spending by category for each of these different people that would be coming from outside the state. And we broke that down into hotel spending on hotels, restaurants, retail, other transportation, et cetera. Now, so that's very important to know. And also those who are coming from outside the state, we know how far they're coming from. They're not just coming typically from over the border, whether that's Iowa or Wisconsin or something like that. Most of these people are coming from farther away. So their spending is higher per capita because these are overnight net new spenders and visitors versus maybe some that are new to the city of Minneapolis, which they're more likely to be from nearby. And so fewer as a ratio are spending the night. So you'll see that here coming up. This is a lot of numbers. On slide 20 here, I would look at this light blue column here. And this is the new spending to the state over the past period. And we look at it, and again, 34% in-stadium spend, 66% outside the stadium. So most of the impact is coming outside the stadium, which is impacting local businesses, hotels, retail, restaurants, other places where people want to spend money, again, Uber drivers, transportation-related things. And that is because most of these folks are coming from farther away. So that is a propensity to stay overnight in hotels and spend more on their trip. When we look at the sort of the three acts, construction, operations historically, operations projected forward, we have the total nominal dollars here and then the present value dollars on the far right column. And that's how we get to this $14.2 billion, the earnings here. So these are all the numbers that were also in the first slide. But this is just the breakdown there. Then briefly, the same idea for the city of Minneapolis. Again, because the jurisdiction is smaller, much a higher percentage of people are coming from outside that jurisdiction to come to the city for events at the stadium. And so it's about 4 out of 5. And you can see there that 16% of Vikings attendees are from the city of Minneapolis, 84% from outside the city, et cetera, et cetera. So you can go down the list and see the same. And we can see the projections going forward. And by the way, the technology that we use for this is called Placer.ai, and basically that's cell phone tracking data where they use algorithms. They don't track every single phone, but if there are more than 200 people gathered in any one place, then they can start to do those algorithms and ping off of the different towers and find out all the information. And where the cell phone sleeps is where people are counted as living. So they know that in the overnight hours, they pull the demographics of that neighborhood that this phone sleeps in, or the phones of the people in that demographic. And that's how we get all these types of information. We also know where people go before and after, how much time they spend in an event facility. So there's all kinds of data that we can pull, and it's really fascinating. And it helps us make these estimates very, very accurate compared to counting license plates like we used to have to do. Net new spending to the city, same concept here. You can see, again, most of the folks coming that are net new to the city are going to be more localized and not necessarily a higher percentage spending the night. And so their per capita spending is going to be a little bit lower. Here, that's why you see that 63% of the net new local spending is occurring in stadium and 37% out, because most of those folks are not spending the night in hotels or not having as many meals and that kind of thing. So again, it's all pretty fascinating, and logically it makes a lot of sense. So 30-year impact, again, these two columns match what we talked about on the first column or the first couple of slides with the summary, and then the return on investment. So again, tax dollars in, tax dollars out. So here, this is how we broke this down. We've seen these numbers before, $518 million in nominally, $1.63 billion out for a net to the state of $1.1 billion, and then reduced amounts for the present value of those dollars. And then here, with MMB and MSFA, we were able to make sure that we incorporated all of the monies that were spent and then collected to net out to get that $517.8 million and or the 2025 dollars of $695 million. So that's how we got to those numbers. City of Minneapolis has a whole different setup for how they participated in this, and so it was a more, in some ways, more complex assessment. And so we had a number of what we call convention center taxes that were extended in order to support this venue as well as other major projects that the city of Minneapolis wanted to make sure they were able to support. So there were taxes called the convention center taxes that were extended, and that includes city sales tax, entertainment tax, lodging and entertainment tax, and restaurant and liquor tax. And so those are all counted here. And when those were, we only counted the numbers when they were really afforded to this venue as opposed to before that time frame. So for the city of Minneapolis, same kind of concept. We have the what was spent and what will be spent, as their whole setup is different than the state's. States is essentially been completed. Then we have the repayment essentially in net new taxes, and so we have the net here, and all the detail is shown on slide 32. Then again, just to, as a reminder on the neighborhood east, you have this area here, and before, of course, we had the dome before that, and you just had a lot of, you can see here, the buildings and the areas that have been redeveloped over time. So much less surface parking, much more dense, walkable, neighborhoody. And it's really been interesting to see. Here's a before and an after, and you can see just the sheer amount of surface parking compared to what's there now. So a very different reality from just, you know, it's surprising that this was just about 15 years ago or so. And then here over time, what's also interesting, and this is about the last slide that we're gonna do before we wrap up, we can see that, of course, office post-COVID is not so much of a good idea anymore, but it was for a while. But consistently, we've seen multifamily, which is great. So there's continued investment in residential in and around this, which is great for the neighborhood, it's great for the venue, it's great for Minneapolis, and really the entire jurisdiction, all the jurisdictions there. We've had hotel investment, and as well as retail has been included in a lot of these developments. So again, lots of great things that have occurred. Really, I think you can point directly to this investment, you know, but you know, had there not been an investment there, I don't think you would have seen this kind of development in and around the venue. So with that, I will wrap this up and be open to any comments or questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hunden.
Sorry to go long. Apparently, I just got a bunch of messages that popped up saying you need to wrap it up. I apologize.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Vekic, for sending that. So I'll just ask an obvious question and preface it. If I were to somehow become possessed and become a Taylor Swift fan, which I am not, what is the economic impact of a concert night from a Taylor Swift concert, if you would, if you can put it in that much of an abstraction?
It would have to be abstract because we don't have the models for that. We have it modeled into the overall models, and we could get that information for you, but I don't have that now. I think conceptually, of course, she was such a draw that, you know, just like any other I think you would consider her a marquee event almost, even though we put her concerts under concerts. But what you had was downtown hotels hitting 95% occupancy, mm-hmm. About 10,000 hotel room nights occupied. So anytime you have, a big major event like that, you're going to see big, big impacts. And when we looked at cell phone data, we can find, again, see where these folks are coming from. So just the ability to host these, and, you know, Taylor Swift, whether you like her or not, she did not go to every city. She went to a handful of cities around the country, and where she went, people came from hundreds and hundreds of miles around. And so, yeah, absolutely massive in impact from these events. And, you know, it's a different subset of a study, but I think in an abstract answer, the short answer is big impact.
Okay. Appreciate that. We'll go to some member questions. I think Representative Jones, you're remote. You'd like to ask a question, so please unmute and proceed.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Hundon, for this presentation. I have two questions. The first question is on slide 15. You have estimate the number of new visitors, both new to the state of Minnesota and new to the city of Minneapolis. Why is there a negative sign for 26% and 81%?
That is
Mr.
a Hunden. Tilde, not a negative
Mr.
sign. Hunden.
We'll speak through the chair if you would. It's maybe a different experience, but we go through the chair. So, Mr. Hunden, go ahead with your answer.
Thank you. Apologies. That is a tilde, not a negative sign. So it is an approximate symbol.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hundon. Apologies for not, my eyesight, I guess, is not good enough. My second question is on more to slide 11, because you're looking at, you have the historical and projected attendance, and in the projected, I believe that's what you have in the box. I think you have, if I'm viewing this right, you estimate that there will be marquee events going forward. I'm just curious, kind of like with this industry of like giant new stadiums that come online, it seems like every year in a new city. And so that, like, you know, there's more competition. So what, does the likelihood of having a marquee event go down as the facility ages? Can you speak to that?
Mr. Hunden.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I think conceptually, yes, for Super Bowls, there does tend to be a practice or a trend of the NFL rewarding cities and stadiums and teams that have invested in new facilities to get a Super Bowl. But that is not to say that Super Bowls can't happen multiple times in a city after having done the first one. So that may be true there. However, you have other events like the NFL draft bid with 600 to 800,000 attendees. You have NCAA regionals and Final Four events that you can continue to bid on. And there are cities that continue to successfully host Final Fours as examples. And many major other events like, swimming trials and the like. So while it may be a little bit true for Super Bowl specifically, for all other kinds of events, it really comes down to, and we've done this kind of analysis for many cities, including just recently for Washington, D.C., as it was seeking answers on how to host the most marquee events in the country. And there are certain cities that have been very successful in doing that. I would say Minneapolis has, you know, done a pretty decent job of that, although it's not always hosting Final Fours and that kind of thing. It's a coordination between facility, city, state, sometimes incentives, things of that nature, in order to land those events. And so it really has more to do with the coordination and bringing everything to bear to bid for those events than it is simply looking at a stadium gets one shot at the beginning, and then from there on it doesn't really have as much of a shot. It really has to do with the boots on the ground coordination and packages that you're willing as city, state, and venue to, and coordination with public safety and all that, to get the NCAA and other major event rights holders to give you the bid for a big event.
Very good, Mr. Hunden. Thank you so much. Mr. Vekic, thanks for being here. I'll just speak on your behalf before we'll give you a minute to close. I'll just say if members would like to take a tour, Mr. Vekic has always been very helpful in getting that set up. If you've never been to the stadium, you should go. If you've never been to the stadium for a concert, you should go. I went to U2. It was great. Not Taylor Swift. Representative Kraft, I saw you raise your eyebrow. But it's an asset that if you're going to make decisions from a governance perspective, you should at least go by and check it out. So Representative Cleburne to conclude.
Thank you. I just had one quick question, and then we can move on.
And Madam Chair, I did not see that Representative Quam had a question, so I wanted to give you the ability to close, make sure. So Representative Quam, very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at some of the data included, I found some things exaggerated, because especially the more than 300 Minnesota businesses with the construction that, and frankly, I know of one entity just in one city that far exceeds that, and the same thing for all this huge numbers. Well, frankly, that's a fraction of what one entity in one city has regularly. So I think that members of the committee need to realize that, ooh, this sounds special, but it's really just a fraction of what one entity in one of the cities that I have in my district has for construction, for millions of visitors. Yeah, so this is a fraction of what the effect on the state economy from just one entity in my district.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bonner, and then we'll go to Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. To the testifiers, I had actually a couple questions, and I'll try to be brief, but
please do.
I'm very curious.
Other folks to get to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very curious about how we collected this data, and specifically how we know certain parts of the data. How do we know that this is a new visitor? How do we know that this person is from out of state? How do we know whether they stayed in a hotel room? Are we looking at occupancy rates to try to discern that? And how do we know whether those occupancy rates are related to a sporting event versus just folks being in town for other conventions or other events? And I'm hoping you can help me understand that, because I may have a follow-up.
Mr. Hunnen or Mr. Vekic, do you want to briefly address the methodology that you use to ascertain that?
I'll defer to Mr. Hunnen, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Hunnen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the question. This came up before. Because, I mentioned the cell phone tracking data that we have, which is absolutely critical to this analysis. So that data, again, shows where people live. It shows, so what we do is we draw what we would call a geofence around a specific POI or a point of interest, and we can be very specific to make sure it's inside the walls of the venue and all of that. You can also, do something on the street if you wanted to, like if it's a street festival. We can set the dwell time so that they have to at least have been in the facility or in the POI for a minimum of 30 minutes versus someone that might be just passing through. So we have all those capabilities. Then we know we have a list of where people go before and after they visited that POI. So we know if they're going to hotels, we know if they're going to restaurants, and that gives us a really good sense of those kinds of things. We also, of course, can look at the hotels as POIs and understand if where the people who are staying there are coming from, and we can triangulate that to understand if they're coming from an event. So we have a variety of ways of doing this. For most of the events and venues, because they are pretty substantial events, we are making an assumption that, for example, for a Vikings game or for a major concert or for a marquee event, that is the inducing reason that the person is making the trip in, versus if it was certainly a local event, right? You have those hundreds of local events every year. First of all, we're not even counting it if the people didn't come from outside the jurisdiction. But if they did come from inside the jurisdiction because it's local, we're not going to necessarily assume that was the reason for their visit to the place. Right. So for the 10% of people that came from outside of the jurisdiction, you know, we do make some assumption that there is an inducing factor there, but typically people will add on smaller events to these big marquee events, but the kinds of things that are happening in U.S. Bank Stadium are the things that don't happen all the time. And so people have to make space in their calendar, make travel plans. And so our assumption is, for the most part, that is the reason that they're making the trip to the state and or the city. Now,
Mr. Hunnan, if I could, in the interest of time, we have an agenda that we still have to get to. I'm going to say perhaps you could make an appointment with Representative Bonner to talk about your methodology. Very briefly, Representative Bonner.
Thank you. So part of the reason I asked, one, is to try to understand better the content of the data. But you said something that struck me a little bit odd, and I'm just going to point it out here and be very transparent. As of last year, many of you may know we passed comprehensive consumer data privacy laws. Those have very specific requirements around geolocation data, and specifically precise geolocation data, including things that might include, for example, where someone lays their head for the night. And I have real concerns about this specific data set. And if we have in some way, through the use of this data, violated Minnesota state law on consumer data privacy protections. And so I'm just calling that out very publicly because it really concerns me. And I can certainly talk with the authors and folks offline about this particular issue along with Representative Elkins, but certainly this is something that is of concern to me, and that's the way I ask for clarification on that specific point. Thank you.
And Mr. Hunnan, if you could, what was the time frame in which you made the data collections on these?
The data collection, all the data analysis was done about a year ago. We started this in February of 2025 and really completed most of our data analytics by the end of the spring, essentially. It was really about a three-month period. And then for the last, you know, 9 or 10 months after that, it's really just been edits and drafts and that kind of thing. So all the data was collected before that. The source is Placer.ai, and there are different states with different requirements that have gone into effect or prohibitions. And so Placer does not allow any of its users to access data that's now prohibited. There have been prohibitions on Placer-style data from, say, hospitals or schools or things like that since the very beginning. So as new laws are passed, they're very, in our experience as a user of this data, we just simply can't get data that is not legally allowed.
Very good. I just wanted to put that on the record that data was collected prior to the law being put into effect. Chair Cleburne.
Thank you, and I appreciate Vice Chair Bonner's question because I'm a data privacy person, and sometimes it's a little bit creepy to realize just exactly how much data is being collected on all of us. My question had to do with the coordinated packages that you talked about for marquee events as a stadium ages with city, state, venue, as I think you called it, cooperation. If you could, in the future, send an email to Chair Nash and I and just kind of let us know what those packages would look like, and then we can share that with the rest of the committee. We don't have to go through the full analysis now, but typically when a stadium becomes 20 years old, what kinds of incentives do cities and states have to provide? That's the question I'm looking at.
Thank you, Chair Cleburne. And Mr. Hunnan, I will ask for Mr. Briggs, Mr. Vekic, and yourself to coordinate that and then disseminate that back to the committee. Mr. Vekic, to conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you can see, this report is significant in the value that the stadium has brought and will bring to the state as well as the city. The important thing to remember, and we're talking about marquee events, is that I wanted to make a point, is that we're one-third through this report. The projections are dependent upon keeping this facility in a world-class position here, and that is in statute as well as contractual relationships with the Vikings, et cetera. So if we do not keep this in a world-class condition, we will most likely not attract the kind of marquee events and other events that are necessary to complete these projections. So therefore, my comment is that as it's statutory that we would be looking to the state to provide those kinds of funding going forward. We have at this point in time in the next decade $300 million worth of renovations and replacements. We're coming to 10 years old in their major here. So, Mr. Chair, as you and your members are well aware of that, thank you. But that is an important viewpoint of keeping it in a world-class position. Thank you.
Mr. Vekic and team, thank you for being here this morning. Again, we'll work with Mr. Briggs to follow up with any questions that may have occurred from today. So next on the agenda, we have the Department of Administration presentation on space utilization update and state office building update. So if you would, please come to the test fire table, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Wayne Wislowski, and I'm Assistant Commissioner at Department of Administration. With me today is Greg Ewig. He's the Director of Senior Director of Real Estate and Construction Services, as well as Eric Riedel. He's the Construction Operations Manager within the Real Estate and Construction Services Division. Greg will walk through the spatialization update, and Eric will walk us through the state office building update.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Wozlowski. My name is Greg Ewig. I am, as mentioned, the Senior Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. I'll be updating you on the Strategic Facilities Plan for the state's portfolio and speak a bit about our status with space use today. I'd like to begin with a brief refresher of the background behind the state's Strategic Facilities Plan. The Department of Administration has statutory responsibility for managing state property, which includes reexamining space needs and approaches to the portfolio. To that end, in October 2021, we engaged the real estate firm CBRE to assist us with the development of a statewide strategic facilities plan. Over the course of this work, we examined how hybrid work was changing agency space needs and identified opportunities to right-size our footprint while still supporting agency missions. This work allows us to refine statewide space standards, develop long-term strategies, and establish best practices for hybrid work environments. We finalized the Strategic Facilities Plan in 2023 and began rollout thereafter. The plan continues to serve as our roadmap for making decisions about state office space moving forward. So the timeline here depicts our initial efforts to prepare space consolidations among our agencies. This was before return to office. I'll speak about how we modified our approach after return to office a little later in this presentation. Based on the strategic plan, we opted to focus our efforts on the larger leases with pending expiration dates. This included agencies such as the DNR, Commerce, and others. We had agency-to-agency discussions and did roll out toolkits for agencies to use in preparing for space sharing. We also use CBRE to assist with space and fit planning for several of our agencies with space on the Capitol complex, including the Department of Health, Agriculture, DHS, Revenue, Minute, and MnDOT. Starting in late 2023, we worked with agencies to incorporate the Strategic Facilities Plan recommendations into their space planning profiles. The state did enjoy some early successes as part of this effort as we sought to right-size our building and lease footprints. For example, the Department of Administration reduced its footprint by about 25%. Revenue and MMB both reduced theirs by 20% each. Department of Health opted not to renew a 100,000-square-foot commercial lease, and Minute was able to reduce their footprint significantly in their move to Stassen from Centennial Office Building. The strategic plan also helped us frame the three core questions we use when discussing space with agencies. First, how do we best serve Minnesotans? We start by looking at each agency's mission and how services are delivered. Some work simply requires staff to be on site full-time, and space planning reflects their operational needs. Second, what type of space is needed to work effectively? We focus on matching the workspace to the work being done. When employees are in the office, we prioritize space that supports collaboration, teamwork, and meetings, but we also balance the need for quiet, heads down space for work that needs to get done. And third, how do we plan for variable and shared occupancy? Hybrid work means we no longer need a one-to-one workspace to employee ratio, so the plan accounts for greater flexibility in shared spaces. We've continued to work with agencies to use space more efficiently, including reducing total square feet per FTE. However, you'll notice the rectangle highlights two areas where we've adjusted our approach to better match the return to office requirement of 50%. First, we've moderated our sharing ratio so it accounts for the new return to office requirements and are less aggressive than when originally rolled out. And second, employees initially had the choice to have an assigned seat if they worked in the office 3 days a week or more. With return to office, that's no longer feasible. The rest of the plan's priorities remain in place and continue to guide our work today. That includes using the sharing model as the baseline when evaluating for space use and moving further away from one-to-one assigned workstations and toward shared multi-purpose areas that can serve a wider range of teams and activities. As we continue to shift towards more flexible and activity-based work environments, we also are consolidating our footprint on the Capitol complex, wherever it makes operational and financial sense. And by pulling scattered functions together, we're seeking to improve collaboration and reducing ongoing facility costs. At the same time, we'll continue to identify and remove obsolete or underutilized space. We're only investing in areas that truly support agency missions. And finally, as our lease spaces approach their expiration dates, we take a fresh look at each one and determine whether renewal, consolidation, or exit is the right strategic choice. A couple other comments here. We introduce space sharing norms that we have promoted when we evaluate space needs for upcoming lease expirations. We've tested those norms at the Department of Administration and promoted the shared space norms with several agencies during their lease renewals. We've recommended organizing around neighborhoods with first come, first serve options for workstations. And we really use these key norms as the baseline and then account for specialized agency needs, such as in certain clinical, legal, or public safety settings. The strategic plan also recommended demolishing unused or obsolete space, including the Ford Building, which was demolished in 2024, and the Centennial Office Building, which is currently part of the governor's capital budget request this session, and would take approximately 240,000 square feet of usable square footage out of the portfolio. So as mentioned earlier, the return to office did have an impact on how agencies planned their space. Return to office, which was announced in March of 2025 and became effective in June, requires most state agency employees to work in person for at least 50% of scheduled work days in a given month. Each agency is responsible for bringing their space into compliance, and the majority have or are finalizing furniture and outfitting to be in full compliance. And we continue to apply the strategic plan principles in the new return to office policy. Here's an overall scan of the agencies that reduced their office footprint and others that are working on it as we speak. Some of the key takeaways I'd like to highlight, all the agencies listed in the green column reduced their large lease spaces since 2020. In the green column, you'll notice asterisks next to MMB, Minute, and MDH. Each had to obtain some additional space or repurpose their existing space to reach compliance with the return to office. However, all agencies are still occupying less square footage than they did in 2020. Some more specific examples. MMB did seek some lease space for their smaller management and analysis team off the Capitol complex. MDH is currently seeking some additional lease space in St. Paul, and Minute is building out an additional square footage in Stassen that had been vacated by revenue to accommodate the return to office. And a few other remarks just regarding leases and space planning, just to give you a little bit of an illustration of what's happening with return to office. The Department of Commerce has just signed a new lease. They are reducing their square footage from a high of 89,000 square feet to about 72,000 square feet at their headquarters. The DNR is actively seeking a 100 to 110,000 square foot space in and around St. Paul that would be reducing their overall space needs from about 140,000. DHS is continuing to evaluate their space needs, especially in their lease location. And MnDOT, depending on the outcome of the Centennial Office Building demolition, would reduce their footprint by about 60 to 70,000 square feet to accommodate new tenants in the transportation building. As we move forward, our commitment is to promote space sharing in all new leases and buildouts, make thoughtful exceptions where shared space simply doesn't work, and use strategic leasing to meet our 50% in-office goal. Anytime we buy or build space, we're taking on a 50 to 100 year obligation, and there are many times where we do need to own space. However, leasing also gives us the flexibility to adapt to workforce needs, budget realities, and policy changes over time. The strategy keeps our footprint efficient, responsive, and ready for whatever direction the future brings. And with that, I'll stand ready for any questions the chair and committee members may have.
Thank you, Mr. Abbott. Question for an offline answer, because we're trying to catch up to the calendar. So would love to understand the formula for leased space offsite versus space potentially utilized or could be utilized in Centennial once the House vacates that. I've asked this question any number of ways, any number of times in meetings in my office. I'd really like to be able to understand what would the cost per square foot be to the state to either keep Centennial as is, because apparently if it's good enough for us, it might be good enough, you know, for anybody, versus what is the cost per square foot that you're paying off-site for the lease spaces. If you have a very quick answer, that's great. If not, let's maybe send an email to everybody on the committee.
Mr. Chair, we can certainly follow up with more details, but I'll just say a couple of things. First of all, Centennial Office Building will be about 70% vacant once the House and other entities move over to the State Office Building in 2027. We have significant deferred maintenance in the Centennial Office Building. So from a mechanical, electrical, we have electrical infrastructure that dates back to the original construction. You can't find the equipment anymore. You can go down the building systems. We're really at the point of needing to make a decision. Do you invest in major renewal of that building, renovation of that building to bring up the building systems, or do we proceed with demolition? And our recommendation on that from a cost standpoint is demolition.
Certainly appreciate that. Again, I don't think anything's going to happen this year from a funding perspective to demolish that building. One, because we're, you know, still there. But just wanted to understand the formula for that, and I think all of us on the committee would be very keen to look at what is the cost overall. So
certainly, Mr. Chair, we'll follow up with that.
Representative Sexton, you have a question, and then we're gonna try to move on to the next Davis as well. So Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. My question revolves around have we thought about the Centennial Office Building being government-owned, contractor-operated? I mean, it's in a great location. Lobbyists would love to have a floor of that, potentially. We've got the security generally designed in to do something like that. An offline answer would be fantastic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sexton, we can follow up on that. It's general geo-bond finance property, so that comes with restrictions on private use of the property.
Representative Davis.
Follow up with more details.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. What percentage of space is unoccupied at the Department of Transportation building?
I'm not sure who'd like to take that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, the transportation, that it's fully leased, so it's all under the Department of Transportation's lease agreement. Really what's happening now is it's underutilized, and there's an opportunity to restack that space. And as Mr. Ewing noted, you know, you're looking at about a 60,000 square feet of space that could be essentially repurposed to use for other state agencies.
Representative Bonner, very briefly, and then we are moving on.
Thank you. I'm just curious, we talked a little bit about the return to work policy that came about, and this is after we had started making some investments and in trying to downshift. And I'm curious, you mentioned that we did have to take out additional leases for MMB, Minute, and MDH in order to fulfill those obligations. Do we have any idea what the cost of that those additional leases are?
And if you would answer very briefly and then provide data in an email to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, don't have that information with, but we can certainly follow up for the committee.
Okay, thank you very much. We will now move on to state office building update. I'm not sure who will take over from here.
Mr. Riedel.
Please introduce yourself for the committee and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Thank you, committee. I'm Eric Riedel. I'm the construction operations manager with the Department of Administration. We'll go through an overview of the state office building progress to update some scheduled milestones. Substantial completion of the building, we are tracking July of 2027. From July of 27 to August of 27, we are going to be engaging in some final building commissioning, furniture installation, final clean, and some operational setup for the house sergeant, house IT, security, and house public information. And then September 2027 is when everybody moves in. We are currently tracking within budget on the project. We are not foreseeing any overages. We're going to go through some slides now, identifying photographs of the site and some current updates and forecasts. For the purpose of this presentation, we're going to speak to the building in zones. Zones 1 and 2 are the addition. Zone 3 is the existing current building. Zone 4 is the loading dock area. Zone 1, some work summaries that are currently ongoing. In the Zone 1 space, we are going through drywall installation, taping, sanding, painting. Ceiling system installation is happening now, and elevator installation. Zone 2, similar work, ongoing drywall, taping, sanding, painting, ceiling installs, flooring installation. We're working on restroom buildouts and also working on millworking cabinetry. Milestones. Some milestones we're tracking now here through the summer months is hearing room ceiling installation, some flooring prep for install, and lighting installation. Zone 2, we're tracking mechanical equipment startup, elevator install and testing, and flooring installation. Some photographs here of current status. The photo on the left, on your slide pack left, is the third floor hearing room. You'll notice the photos there just have work on our ceiling install. Photo on the right is the fifth floor large hearing room. Moving on to additional hearing rooms, you'll notice the photo on the left is a little bit more refined finish on the ceiling work and the wall work and the room itself. And then the photo on the right is a different large hearing room on the fifth floor. Photo on the left is the north lobby space. That is the lobby space that is directly outside of the Leif Erikson statue facing university. Apologies for the photo on the right. That is our central atrium or common space. There's just a lot of scaffolding going on right now there with wall and ceiling work. We're going to move into the existing building, Zone 3. Some work summaries ongoing in Zone 3, the original building. We're a little further ahead in the original building than in the addition. We're working on painting, flooring, ceiling installation. We're working on the light wells or the courtyard atrium spaces on the east and west side, the east courtyard. Stone installation is nearing completion. Flooring work is continuing, and restroom buildouts are ongoing. Zone 4, we are currently working on the loading dock, and the stairway link between the parking ramp and the building is ongoing as well. Some milestones for Zone 3, the original building, ongoing finishes through duration of project and lighting installation. Zone 4, our milestones are loading dock completion and then stairway link stone installation. the next slides, we're going to be looking at some before and after photos. So you'll notice the photo on the left, that is a shot of one of the courtyards. That is October of 2024. The photo on the right is January of 2026. Some member and staff areas. The photo on the left is from November of 2024 to current March of 2026. Walls are finished, door frames are in, ceilings are going in. Member office, shot on the left is November of 2024, some basic framing. The photo on the right is our mock-up office. This is the one we use to make sure all the fits and finishes are right, the colors are right, the carpet is right. So there's a sample of that mock-up office in February of 26. Some of the other sample member offices are photographed here. You notice painting is finished, wall mill work is done, and we're working on the final ceiling installation and lighting. Current progress on restrooms. Photo on the left we have here is of the loading dock excavation. So we have the pit dug for it. We're working on footings and foundations and then subsequent walls and finishes on the loading dock. The photo on the right is the interior photograph of the link to the ramp. We'll go through some site progress photographs here. So some milestones for site work. This is everything on the exterior of the building. Over the summer here and fall, we're going to be working on hardscapes. So we're going to be working on sidewalks. We're going to be working towards final grading plan. And then exterior stonework is going to be ongoing through the duration of the project. We'll do some compare and contrast as well. Photo on the left is from August of 2024. Shows before the addition was fully constructed. And then the photograph on the right is from March of 2026. The photo on the left, just for clarification, is from University Avenue looking at the SOB. The photo on the right is from Rice Street looking at the addition. Some further exterior site photos. Photo on the left is from October of 2024, and the photo on the right is from March of 2026. Continuing on, photo on the left is from November of 2024. First few floors of the new addition are installed, the steel's erected. The photo on the right is from January of 2026. Our final photo slide here is a sample of the tunnel. So the photo on the left is from October of 2024, where we've demoed the section of the tunnel from MLK to the building. The photo on the right is the completed enclosed tunnel from December of 2026. On that, I thank you all.
Very good. Thank you for that. Members, we're going to take 2 minutes max on questions before we move to the next thing. So if anybody has a burning question that they need to ask right now, I have Representative Sexton and Representative Kraft, and then we'll go to Chair Claiborne. Okay, Representative Sexton.
Can you give us the sum total of the validated change orders, contested change orders, and what the overall contingency budget is?
And whoever would like to handle that.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we can certainly follow up with that on with the original construction cost, and we can send that out to the committee and as well as all the change
Representative orders. Sexton.
Nothing
further. Okay, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I know, but can you talk about why we're now in September of 2027 instead of, I think that is a pushback from the initial plans of when we would get into the space.
And to whomever would like to handle that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, so the schedule hasn't changed since, you know, probably, you know, we're over 18 months ago or so when the schedule was updated. So we're before this committee last year, it was that same time frame that we have today. The original schedule that was contemplated a possible completion in December of 2026, so going back to the before the actual construction started, there was some site conditions that drove related to the addition that drove the additional time that was needed.
And then Kraft, good. Representative Bonner, very briefly.
And so you said substantial completion of all four of the zones, all three buildings, is set for 2027. Do we know when is the when Zone 3 specifically is set for completion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, from a building system standpoint, it's all the same time. It'll be one substantial completion date. We'll have the main building, the work, a lot of the work will be done, but the building systems, the life safety systems, the fire alarm systems are all interconnected within the system, within the whole facility, so you don't have two separate substantial completion dates, even though your construction progress is, the main building's gonna look more completed than the addition.
Does that, Mr.
Representative Bonner?
Does that include the safety and security upgrades that were needed, and are we able to do those in parallel with the timeline? I'm just curious because it looks like we've added a considerable amount of time onto that timeline. And, you know, as a project manager myself, we do a lot of things in parallel tracks. And I'm trying to better understand if there's a way to shore up those timelines and bring those in and do more parallel tracks in terms of updating those systems and getting that building ready to go.
And perhaps we can just do that offline, if you would. I'm sure there.
We have a minute.
All right, Mr. Wozlowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner. So those that's already accounted for in the schedule as far as the opportunities that we have for parallel tracks. The substantial completion date is tied to the occupancy permit. It's when we can a building code official will allow us to have folks in there occupying the facility. And then there's a period of time where we'll have the setup for the operational side of it from a security standpoint, from an IT standpoint. And really the intent is to make this transition as smooth as possible so that when the tenants move in, everything is working the way it should.
Very good. And Co-Chair Cleburne deferred to Representative Bonner. So thank you for the presentation. Yeah. Members, if you have questions, please reach out offline or go through chairs or CAs for questions to be sent to the department. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, we have an informational hearing on House File 4912. Informational hearing on 4912. Representative Witte, if you would. I need to move it in front because it's informational hearing. And Representative Witte, we have at the max 15 minutes for this. So if you would. Given that this is an informational hearing, I do not need to move the bill before the committee, so please just talk to the construct of 4912.
Good morning, Chair Nash, Chair Cleburne, and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for taking the time to hear House File 4912. It's a bipartisan bill with also Representative Tapke to support the thoroughbred racing industry in Minnesota. The bill appropriates $2 million annually beginning in fiscal year 2027 from revenue generated from the tax imposed on electronic pull tab games to the Minnesota Racing Commission. The bill requires the Racing Commission to use the funds to supplement purses and provide incentives to breeders and owners to promote the Minnesota bred thoroughbred racing industry. Today you will hear from my testifiers about the difficulty financial realities the thoroughbred racing community is facing. I recognize that this may not be the perfect solution. Other things that would assist the industry that are being contemplated in the legislative include sports betting and expanding advanced deposit wagering in races in Minnesota. This industry is facing a difficult future. We need to meet that moment and support the racing industry, and I'll turn it over to my testifiers. Thank you.
All right, so if you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Justin Revac, R-E-V-A-K, and I represent the Minnesota Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. Carry on. The Minnesota, the HBPA strongly supports House File 4912, and we appreciate Representatives Witte and Tapke for bringing this important legislation forward. Thoroughbred racing in Minnesota is at a critical crossroads. As additional forms of gambling have been legalized, competition for gaming dollars has intensified. In states that allow racetracks to enhance purses through sports betting, other gaming revenues, or direct support from state governments, the industry is thriving. In states where racetracks are excluded from those revenues, tracks are struggling and closing. Horse racing is unique because horse owners can easily relocate their horses to other states offering higher purses. When you look at the economics of thoroughbred racing in Minnesota, it is becoming more and more difficult to justify for owners to justify sending their horses to Canterbury. Costs to keep a thoroughbred in training continue to rise while purses continue to fall, and the ability to even break even becomes very difficult. Canterbury Park is a remarkable racetrack, and Canterbury management and the HBPA have created the most welcoming and family-friendly stable area in the country with incredible programs such as Furlong Learning for the Kids, Abijah's for Mental Health, and our Canterbury Chaplaincy. These efforts have built a strong loyalty among horsemen and horsewomen that has kept them coming back year after year. However, losing more money each year can only last so long, and the thoroughbred racing will come to an end without new streams of purse revenue. Owners will either stop sending their horses to Canterbury or get out of the game altogether. So you might ask, who will benefit from the additional funding from this bill? This bill will benefit the entire local racing industry as well as the community. Owners will be able to hopefully lose less money and stay in the industry longer, which in turn benefits trainers, grooms, exercise riders, hot walkers, jockeys, shoers, veterinarians, local feed and supply vendors, hay farmers, Minnesota breeders, Canterbury employees, and all the other people whose livelihoods depend on this industry in Minnesota. The bottom line is the thoroughbred industry in Minnesota needs help, and the Minnesota HBPA urges you to support this bill because it will help the industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rivak. If you would, let Mr. Sampson come up and take your seat. And then I'm gathering this is Ms. Mixon. If you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Sally Mixon. Hi. I am a backsider. That is somebody who works in the barns at Canterbury Park. I'm an exercise rider, so I gallop horses 6 days a week, sometimes seven. I love it. I'm also the chaplain at Canterbury Park. There is this false narrative that I've heard over the years being there that when purses go up or that the racing industry in general is about rich owners getting richer. And I will share with you, not every track is like Churchill Downs on Kentucky Derby Day. I wish it was. That'd be cool. But what happens and the people that are most affected when the racing industry starts to deplete is the backsider. It's the people that are up at 4:30 in the morning. It's the people that have sacrificed, for some, everything to come to the U.S. to better their lives. And it's really sad to see. When this sport goes away for the backsider, it's not a sport and it's not a hobby. It's our livelihood. It's absolutely everything. And I know that we make up like 200 to 300 people on the backside of Canterbury Park, and that probably seems really insignificant. And I'm doing my best to show up today and be the voice of a group of people that are rarely seen because we're in the stalls, right? We're scooping poop. We're doing all the things that we need to do to take care of horses and to make the sport something that instills hope, because that's what the racing industry is all about. The underdog, right, has a chance. And the backside population is an underdog. And so I would love for you all just to hear this today and take it to heart as best as you can and remember our faces and be a voice for us who often are not heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mixon. Next, we have Randy Sampson from Canterbury. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randy Sampson. I'm chairman and CEO of Canterbury Park. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to shorten and be very brief because I did provide a letter and don't want to be repetitive and also don't want to, repeat what's already been said here by our other testifiers. But I am here representing approximately 800 year-round employees and 1,500 seasonal workers at Canterbury, as well as the hundreds of thousands of fans each year that have enjoyed the thrill of thoroughbred and quarter horse racing at Canterbury since 1985. While sports betting legislation remains the best option to stabilize purses, the support the support the industry long term, House File 4912 helps address the immediate needs for ensuring that successful live thoroughbred racing can continue in Minnesota. Minnesota racing industry has been under increasing pressure in recent years, and without action, the long-term sustainability of thoroughbred racing in Minnesota is at risk. House File 4912 isn't a permanent solution, but it provides a meaningful source of support that will help stabilize the industry and help preserve the jobs, economic activity, and community benefits that thoroughbred racing brings to Minnesota. We hope that future discussions on this bill and other gaming issues will take into consideration the need to support purses for the racing industry. We look forward to continuing to work with the legislature to pass legislation that will provide the support that our industry needs to not just survive, but to thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Representative Witte, we have a couple of members, or at least one or two members, have questions, so we'll let you kind of figure out who is going to answer that as we move forward. Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if my following is a statement or a question, but I was a mere college student when we built Canterbury Downs. I actually applied for a job there and actually changed jobs before I went on active duty, so I'm also a veteran. I'm really disappointed in this bill. I mean, with the VFW, the American Legion organization, all those folks who are selling tip boards, raising money for their local community, and then putting that back into their community. They're already paying 33% of what they take in on taxes. And now we see the taxes are supporting an organization that promised the public back in the 80s that we would not come back to you for tax money. I'm very concerned. I'm very disappointed.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Representative Sexton, for your comments. And I understand that I'm also on the charitable bill trying to help out our charities. And as I said, this isn't the solution that I would love to bring forward. It's really to kind of hopefully expand it. I know the one piece for me, and I would love to talk offline about it some more on, like I said, not the perfect solution, but I do know Obligia on the backside with the mental health piece. It helps our first responders. It helps our military. And if the thoroughbred racing or Canterbury would fail, that opportunity would not be there. And I do know that the numbers keep increasing as we're trying to support them. So I would love to talk more to you about this. I understand your feelings and would like to have more discussion if possible. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at a meeting in Iowa last winter in the Des Moines area, and it was a beautiful hotel complex with a sports betting casino and a racetrack, and they're thriving down there. The industry in Minnesota needs help. This may not be the ideal solution, but I agree that we need some help. And just from the agricultural standpoint, you mentioned hay farmers, you know, they're hay burners. They eat oats and hay, and the veterinarians and folks behind the track. It's a significant impact to our state's ag industry. So I would support some kind of program that gets the thoroughbred racing folks some help. And thanks for the bill.
Representative Witte or testifiers?
Thank you, Representative Anderson. When we did a tour of Canterbury, on the backside, that was a piece that really impacted me, the impact it has on our farmers, our local economy and that. So obviously, I don't want to see it go away because it will have kind of far-reaching impacts.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I will say I am a little bit in the camp with Representative Sexton on this particular issue. While I very rarely toot my own horn, I'm going to do it right now today. From the day one of entering the Minnesota State Legislature, one of the very first bills that I ever brought forward was in conjunction with Allied Charities. And at that time, they were struggling with being able to support charitable gaming revenues and put that money and reinvest it back into their communities in a really meaningful way. And they were struggling. And For 6 years, I toiled with that bill, and I deeply studied each and every proposal that had come before the legislature, why it failed, why it didn't succeed. I went through, I begged, I pleaded, I talked to tax chairs. I went for 6 years on my knees to get some relief for those organizations. And while I know there are folks in this legislature who have tried to claim credit for that, I'm going to say right here and right now, it was me who sat there for 6 years begging for that until it finally got across the line. And I made sure that as we paid off that stadium, that we made sure to take care of our charitable gaming organizations like Osseo Maple Grove Hockey, the Osseo Lions Club, the Legion, the VFWs. These are folks where they had been waiting for a very long time for relief. And my bill finally delivered that into that tax bill. And so, you know, with over 1,100 organizations bringing in $147 million in 2025, the Legion and the VFW themselves take in 9.5% of that. This is making sure that those institutions stay in our communities, right? And so I really feel like this is maybe the wrong mechanism and the wrong answer. I do want to, though, call out specifically our testifier coming to speak on behalf of the backenders and your courage and your determination to come here today, and I want to thank you for that. I just feel like this bill is maybe the wrong answer to that equation, but I do appreciate you coming to testify.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you, and you can see the passions run strong, both in favor and in opposition. I just want to say two thank yous. Ms. Mixon, when we came, or Chaplain Mixon, when we came and toured, I was really impressed with the work that you do, the compassion that you bring, and not only for the individuals who are doing the work, but for the children who are also there. And that, I just want to really recognize that and know that your voice is heard, because it's really, really important, the work that you do. And to Mr. Sampson, I want to thank you for the economic development that Canterbury also brings to the community. We just heard about the economic development from the Viking Stadium, and we've seen the apartment complexes, the entertainment venues, and things that have gone up in Shakopee around Canterbury, and the economic interest that you have for the larger community as a whole. So I want to recognize that as well. And I'm glad this bill is before us today so that we can talk about it and look for creative solutions. I don't believe in going into venues that take my money, but that's just me, right? Other people really enjoy that. So I do think that we need to be creative and look for avenues to both support the agricultural economy, the backsiders, and that continued economic development in Shakopee. So I thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Chair Cleburne. I will conclude. Representative Witte, you know, you've heard pretty clearly, and I'm going to add my voice to the, I don't believe that this is the pool of money that we should be looking at. You know, I'm very clearly on the same side as the charitable gambling. I would go back to the conversation we had a number of years ago around the historic betting being robbed from you guys. You know, we worked very hard to prevent that or to change that. There are other places that this can come from. I don't think this is it, but I wanted to give you the respect to have this hearing, to have this conversation again. Mr. Sampson, I really enjoyed the tour when we came to the backside. And in fact, and I don't know if Mr. Sampson was the one that made this happen, but one of my constituents was there with, I think, three or four of their horses. Our daughters grew up together. So, you know, this is a benefit to our state. I think that as legislators, we can find a way to figure this out without impacting an equally important other pool of money that is being created. So, you know, I think that we can figure this out. Sorry that this is information only, so no action will happen on this. But I think that there's other places to go looking. So, and with that, Representative Witte, I'll give you the last word.
I just want to say thank you for the time. Thank you for the comments. I think we're all looking for ways to help the different groups out. Just thank you for the time and listening to their stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Witte. Members, Representative Robbins is, I think she's detained in another committee, so we will not be doing an informational hearing for 4664. And with that, we are adjourned.